Thank you for coming. I don't know how you feel, but this is the last presentation before the end of the day. I'll try to get through. Let's make this as interactive as possible and as interesting as possible. What I'm going to be talking about is the job market. I have been in the internet industry since essentially 1994. One of my claims to fame was I got this close to buying Yahoo for $1.4 million. And ever since then, I've been focused on the internet industry. I run a company now called JobVite. Companies use it to manage their entire recruiting process. And really since 1995 for a little bit, and definitely since 1999, I've been heavily focused on the online job market. I ran hotjobs.com for almost 5 years. I was on the board of CareerBuilder when it was a tiny little company. We grew it to something a little bit bigger. So I've been looking at the U.S. labor market for quite some time, and I've never seen it undergo the kinds of changes it's going over right now, which is what I'm talking about. Hopefully it'll resonate with you. How many people here are in the recruiting industry in some form or capacity? Okay. And how many people here are hiring managers who regularly hire people? Okay. So I think this will resonate with you. What I'm going to talk about is what I'm calling the rise of the disposable worker in the past, and that leading to the change about how people look at the job market, how job seekers look at the job market, how we as employees look at the job market. I'm going to talk briefly about where are the future jobs, where are they going to come from, what are they going to be like. And obviously, by definition of having it on the agenda, there's something different about the jobs of the future as opposed to the jobs of the past. And why is that the case? And then I'm going to spend some time talking about the importance of education in this equation and what's going on in the world of education and the job market. And then that as background lead to my thesis here that the contract between employees and employers has been undergoing change for quite some time and is now even dramatically different, and how that therefore we as future job seekers or we as hiring managers or recruiters are going to have to change the way we behave. Okay? Before I... this is weird. Well, this is, it looks like somehow the slides are all of a sudden looking different through this presentation, so it's hard to see. What this is the U.S. economy and the recessions, 1973 to 75, the 81 to 82 recession, the 90 to 91, the 2001, and the most recent one we had in 2008. The pink bar and the blue bar represent how companies reacted to the recession. So back in 1970, in the early 70s, my father was coincidentally an executive in HR at Xerox Corporation. And they were experiencing heavy competition from Japanese copiers coming into the U.S. market. And they had a major layoff in the early 70s. And at that time, that was a big no-no. Companies just didn't do that. And in fact, I remember answering the telephone, and we got a threat. Someone was threatening to bomb our house because of my father leading this or having a role in these layoffs. As you can see, that in that first recession, companies responded to the decline in the economy mostly by reduced productivity, cutting non-employee expenses, and only a little bit in layoffs. If we'd shown a recession before 1970, that'd be a lot smaller. And as you can see, ever since then, you can see how industry has responded to recessions. Now, almost the only thing they do is to eliminate labor and cut jobs. It's like the first thing they do. You know, back in the 70s, they would cut the marketing budget and hold on to the people at work. And now they cut the marketing, I mean, they cut the jobs and keep spending on the marketing side. So this will illustrate essentially what I'm getting at. This is a graph that will dynamically show you the gain or loss of jobs in the United States from 2004 to now. So a green bubble represents a net gain in jobs in that geography, and a red bubble represents net job loss. Okay? So this graph essentially starts soon after the early 2000 recession, which was primarily triggered by the tech bubble burst. Okay? Now, I'm going to go right here, and I'm going to fast forward it myself. And you can see the tech bubble finally started to go away. San Francisco, for example, the red dots are disappearing. And we get to mid-2005. Anyone see the little red dot in New Orleans in Louisiana? That was Katrina, and watch what happens there. So all of a sudden there was massive job loss in New Orleans, but you also see that there was job gain in Houston and Texas. Why do you think? Price of oil went up. And the energy industry started to take off. Then you see in Detroit, there in Michigan, the auto industry starting to experience some pain. Now, pretty much we're going along. This was the boom of 2006 and 7. And right about here, look in Florida and look in Southern California. What do you think that those little red dots represent? Any guess? It was the housing market starting to collapse and the drop in construction jobs in the housing industry. Okay, and you can see that starting to grow in Southern California. It eventually catches up in Arizona, another place where there's a lot of... And then, yours truly here, join JobVite, a recruiting platform. And watch what happens right after. So that illustrates how in 18 months, the United States economy shed 8 million jobs. Now today, we had an announcement that we gained in the United States 247,000 jobs, which if you look at the last 2 to 3 years, that's a lot. We had 1 month last year where it was kind of like that. We would have to gain that amount of jobs every month without fail for 3 years just to catch up to the number of jobs that were lost in this recession, number one. Number two, more people are going into the job market, right? We keep graduating people. Baby boomers are holding on a lot longer because they lost a lot of their wealth. But, you know, all signs suggest that things are getting a lot better. But whenever I show that, people go, oh my God, I had no idea it was that big. It was that big. So now I'm going to kind of rifle through some quick stats about the U.S. job market. One, 40% of our population now is either unemployed or underemployed, meaning they're in a job that is below their qualifications. And you can see how worse that is. It's really bad for the people who have less than a high school education, up there in the top, or just a high school diploma. For people with a bachelor's degree, it's a lot less worse. It's not that bad. And you see that when you look at the jobs, this is the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. government, BLS. This is their projection on where the jobs in the future are going to come from. And the jobs in the future that require a doctoral degree are going to grow by 20%. Those a master's degree, 22%. Bachelor's degree, 17%. But those that only require a high school education or even less than that is in the low teens. So we're starting to see this bifurcation in the growth of opportunities in the people who can do them. So therefore, you net that out, this is going to be essentially the surplus versus the deficit of qualified people for those types of jobs. So in the 70s, the U.S. economy generated more jobs for people who have a high school or less education. Today, the economy generates more jobs for people with a college education. That's a huge flip. in a fairly short period of time. So clearly, as you can see, we're going to have a shortage in the United States for people who have master's degrees, and pretty much we're at the friction point on all of the college educated. So, therefore, as you can imagine, people with college degrees are going to demand higher and higher salaries. This is salary growth from 1968 to the present. And I would bet that right now, this morning, the stats said that the average wage in the United States was $28 an hour, and that it was ticking up for the first time in 3 years. So I imagine this is the biggest driver of it, that the wages among people with college education are starting to tick up again. Okay? So when you net that all out, that means that 60% of all the new jobs that are going to be generated in the next 10 years are only going to be doable by 20% of the population. And so for people who are trying to hire skilled labor or college-educated workers, it's not going to get easy. It's actually going to get more difficult. This is a quote from a hedge fund manager who was quoted in the Wall Street Journal. And he says, "Forget about blue-collar and white-collar. There are only two types of workers in our economy now, creators and servers." Almost sounds medieval to some degree. And many servers are going to be replaced by machines, computers, and changes in how business operate. So obviously, what's the root cause of all this today? It's automation, and it's automation driven by essentially the people who are at this conference, software and the internet. So Mark Andreessen, before I tried to buy Yahoo for $1.4 million, I led an investment in a company called Netscape in July of 1994. We bought 3% for $3 million, and my parent company sold it for $110 million, and I didn't get a single penny. I was Mark Andreessen's first customer for his second company called LoudCloud, which was really the first cloud-based hosting environment. It was a little before its time. And he has a really interesting article he writes. It's his thesis. He's right now in Silicon Valley probably the hottest early stage investor now. You know, he's one of two or three. His name comes up all the time. And he his thesis for his new investment firm is that software is going to change everything. It's going to change every category of business. It's going to change how we do almost everything. And we all know about some of these examples, the movie industry, Amazon, obviously with books and music and iTunes and the obvious ones. But it's happening everywhere in lots of places and really quickly. And most people think that, well, maybe that's happening in certain industries, but there'll always be these other kinds of jobs, labor jobs. And certainly if not here, then in India or in China. And I thought this was fascinating. This is a guy who started a call center in India 8 years ago. And every single employee was a high school grad, except for himself and one other or two other people. It's been a fast-growing company, and virtually none of his employees now are high school grads. They're all college graduates. And he said that, "I used to have people who would answer the telephone and just try to decide what to do based on what they heard on the phone. Now I have an algorithm that's determining, based on the inquiry via email, how they get routed to the right person. And I have a lot of PhDs now working on that algorithm." And his quote here is that, you know, if work that you're doing is really routine, then it's going to be automated. That every 2 to 3 years, we're going to be able to essentially scrap labor for some new software-based system. This is... we won't even have waiters. This is a company called E. La Carte. And, I mean, it's not like waiters get paid that much, right? I mean, but they've figured out a way to allow you to order your food. Obviously, it's kind of like an iPad, essentially. And if you get bored, you don't like the conversation you're having with people you're eating with, you can play games, you know. And so you order the food, and the food's delivered. And you know what the cost of this per hour is? Because, you know, a waiter is minimum wage. And what's that now? 10 bucks, something like that? This is 45 cents an hour for them to operate. Guarantee in 5 years, you guys are all going to become familiar with these kinds of ordering systems in restaurants. right? There's lift ticket operators. I mean, the guys I went to high school who maybe didn't jump into college right away, they funded it by going to Colorado and working on a ski lift. One of the largest ski lift operators has now replaced ski lift operators with just a tag. Right? Now, I think this is really, really essentially telling of what we're talking about. And that is, in the 1950s, General Motors was essentially the largest, most valuable company, one of the largest, most valuable companies in the world, and certainly in the United States, and it employed 400,000 people in the United States. Today, who's that company? Apple. They employ 43,000. All right. So clearly, would you think our population has grown since the 50s? And our largest, most valuable company employs 10% what General Motors did in the 50s. So I want to talk a little bit about education and what that means for this economy. Can we do anything about this? Obviously, education is a predictor of who's going to have opportunities in the future and who's not. So we clearly, maybe we should increase education, right? 7 out of 10 people, ninth graders in the United States, will graduate from high school. Now, if you look at it by ethnicity, it's a dramatic difference. White and Asian, it's something like 8 to 8.5. African-American, Hispanic, is something like half, 5. 5 out of 10. We need 5 high school graduates who are in the top 25% quartile of math to create what is called one STEM worker, meaning a science, technology, engineering, or math worker, an employable STEM worker. So we need to have 5 graduate top of their class in the top 25% just to produce one STEM worker. Now, why don't people go into science and technology and engineering? So they surveyed those ninth graders and asked them why. The first reason they said was money. Their perception was it costs more money to pursue science and technology as a profession than it does something else in college. The second was, I have bad grades in math and science. And the third answer was, it takes too much studying. So in 1970, the United States led the world in high school graduation as well as college graduation. And right now, we are 11th in reading, 15th in completing college, 19th in science, 21st in completing high school from 1 to 21, and 26th in math. By the way, my freshman roommate in college was best friends with Sean Penn, so that's why I put his picture there. He went to Santa Monica High School with him. And I actually got him to talk like this when I met him. So the sad thing about it is, if we actually succeeded at getting high school students to graduate more from high school, this is what that math would look like. 23% increase in high school graduates would lead to a 50 to 100, a range between 50 and 100. So this math uses the middle midpoint, 75, in earnings in a lifetime, which would represent to taxpayers $1 trillion in increased taxes. So it would seem this would be a kind of smart investment as opposed to maybe a lot of the buildings that we built in the last decade. Don't mean to editorialize. So let's look at college. I was born between 1961 and 64. You see the you don't have the grade there, but I mean the graph. But if you look at the graduation rates among rich versus poor, in this case, rich is defined as the top 10% earning families, the families that are in the top 10%. You can see back in when the people born when I was among the top 10%, about 33% graduated from college. Now that's almost 56, 57%. It's a whopping increase. I was the first on my mother's side to go to college. And only the second on my father's side. All my kids are going, you know, right? I don't know anyone in our circles who are not sending their kids to college. So you can see that's great, good for us. But look among the poor, it's growing a whole lot more slowly. So IBM has sponsored a software programming contest every year since the early 90s. And it's it involves 150 teams from around the world representing their university to compete to solve some of the nastiest problems, and you only have something like 5 hours to solve the problem. And in 1993, these are the universities that were in the top 12. Harvard was number one, you know, where Mark Zuckerberg went. Obviously Stanford, Caltech, Berkeley, right? Here's in 2011. Only one university from the United States. Everyone talks about how the U.S. universities are the crown jewel, the best in the world. No one, nowhere near as close anywhere else. Only one from the United States made the top 12. So Harvard and Stanford did participate. They weren't in the top 12. Another, I think, troubling statistic when it comes to the supply of college graduates for our economy is, you know, our universities have attracted some of the best and brightest to them. Almost 20 years, the United States consistently had about 25% of the world's foreign students going to school in the United States. And that has suddenly now dropped to 18, meaning they're just deciding to go to universities outside of the United States. And the other problem is the percentage of them, so now they're declining, and the percentage of them who say they're going to stay in the United States after they graduate is declining. And it's now down to only 50% plan to stay, and it used to be upwards of 70%. And then, of course, in the United States itself, we're just not generating enough graduates in science and technology. We're generating business and social science more quickly. But who here has a guess on what's the fastest growing college major in the United States? Anybody? Parks, recreation, and fitness. So I think a lot of our grads may move overseas and work in resorts or hotels. As a major, in 10 years, it's grown 92%. It's the number one major in the United States. Fastest growing, I'm sorry. Number one in growth. I don't know that answer to that question. It wasn't nothing. It hasn't grown from nothing. It's up there in the volume of graduates. This is a picture of, I love it because it's a Chinese medical school. And if you look closely, a lot of the students aren't Chinese. They're from all over the world going to the Chinese medical school. Probably the most mind-blowing statistic, I think, is that China will soon become the largest English-speaking country in the world. I don't know exactly what year, but there'll be roughly 300 million English-speaking in Chinese. You couple that with they're generating 400,000 college graduates in engineering and science, and the United States is generating 150,000. So Microsoft recently announced a month ago that it was going to build a new research lab, you know, basic research, not something that they hope will immediately turn into new technology, a lab in China, not in the United States. Now Xerox, my father's company he worked with forever, had Xerox PARC, and out of Xerox PARC came the graphical user interface, the mouse, the laptop, lots of things. And clearly that kind of basic research eventually, in the long run, leads to the kind of job growth that you want. So the implications are this. Most people think, well, you know, the reason we manufacture iPhones in China is because there's, it's cheap labor. And Obama actually confronted Steve Jobs once. It was a New York Times article, I don't know if you guys saw it, and said, why aren't those jobs going to come back? And this is what he told them, why those jobs won't come back. Because in the United States, if we need to hire 8,700 technically skilled supervisors, maybe not even college grad, but some college, to supervise in a manufacturing process, it'll take us 9 months. That's how long it takes to recruit staff and hire that number of employees in the United States. To do it in China, 2 weeks. And so it's really a scale issue. It's not that they're cheap labor. The cost of labor in China and India are actually going up, and the standard of living is going up as well. So that means then that the United States economy here is going to have to do things differently to compete. We can't compete at that level. We just cannot. So what you often hear about is the great thing about our economy is how innovative it is, and it's creative. And, you know, I put a statistic up there. There was only 43,000 jobs were associated with Apple, that Apple employed. But there is the Apple, the smartphone app economy that's generated 477,000. I think when I was getting my badge, I was in line with about 25,000 of them here. And the interesting there is that a lot of these jobs didn't exist 5 to 6 to 7 years ago. So there was no formal training program for these, right? But they are the jobs that require a formal education in order to do them. Now, this is it's hard to feel sad for a venture capitalist who, I don't know how many venture capitalists are in the audience, if any, but Randy Commissar was at Kleiner Perk and says the job market now for getting engineers to work on iPhone apps, for example, is completely out of control. There's a report that one Stanford undergraduate software programmer was just offered $160,000 right out of college. It's pretty good. So these people, we're going to be fighting them over them in our economy. A lot of the companies here at South by Southwest, this is who we're trying to recruit. So what do these people want? What's going to attract them? And the point I'm going to make now going forward is they want experiences. They don't believe that any company is going to provide them the career path that they need to succeed. They think they have to build their own career path to do what they got to do. So what they're going to look for are the experiences that help them build their career. And then we as employers have to, me running JobVite, for example, I have to create interesting jobs and job opportunities that allow them to grow their career. And so that's why I'm making the argument that we're moving from a world that where you would marry, my father was married to Xerox. Maybe I've represented more of a serial monogamy relationship of every 4 years finding a new spouse, if you will, in the work environment, to almost, I would argue, like speed dating. And so here, this is a study that was done by one of the largest law firms that focuses on labor management, and MIT. And it's trying to forecast what the future of work's going to be like. And they argue that 50% of all new jobs, when we finally kind of catch up from the downturn, perhaps 50% of the work is going to be employed by contingent workers, meaning they're not permanent employees. Okay? Now, a survey of college grads said that half of them half of them think that self-employment is more secure than a full-time job. That's amazing. So this is what they think when they're going into work. So they're skeptical day one when they're interviewing with an employer who says, oh, look, we have this 401k and you can stay here. And yeah, sure. This was a Bureau of Labor Statistics survey of independent contractors. 82% of them said they prefer being an independent contractor to a permanent job. And the reason the BLS published this survey, it was a dramatic increase over the past. When I first put together a business plan to create something called a job board, it was in 1994. I had met with the founder of something at the time that was called the Monster Board. And this is before resume databases. And we built something called CareerPath.com, which I'm sure none of you have ever heard of. I made a presentation to the senior management saying that my father's generation holds 4 jobs in a career. My generation may hold 7. And it's going to, that's a big increase in the amount of recruiting that's going to take place because of that. Look at this. In the United States today, the median tenure in a job now is 4.4 years. So that's a lot more than seven. And in California, it's three. And I think in Austin here, it's probably three, two. If you look at men between the ages of 35 and 64 and ask what percentage of them have had a job for more than 10 years, in 1980, that was 51%. And now it's 39%. And in California, it's 21%. Right? So, I mean, that's just a huge change. Silicon Valley, jobs are growing three times faster than the rest of the country. Therefore, technologists in Silicon Valley today are changing jobs twice as fast and earning twice as much. So they see leaving their current job and going to a new one is a way to, number one, build their career, and number two, get more money, get a promotion. And so, I mean, how many people have here experienced hiring someone who's today under the age of 30 and within 6 months getting the question of, gee, you know, is there a new job I can do or a new salary? I have. And it kind of implicit in my generation was, you at least wait a year before you ask that question. And that they don't. And if you talk to them about it, which I do, like, that's crazy. Why would I wait a year? Because the market's moving. So we've clearly gone from this era, my dad's generation, to one where people now, if you're a college graduate, you will hold a job, at least 10 different jobs in your career. And if you are a technology worker in the United States, it'll be at least 14 jobs in a career. And the other thing is, like, what's that mean? Like, where's the location of the jobs? So this is our own survey, JobVite, we have our own survey. And those who are currently working in a job, currently employed, of those, 61% are open to leaving and finding another job. That's huge. So they're if they're working for you now, they're on LinkedIn, they're sending emails, they're finding out what else is out there. They're always shopping, in other words, for their next gig, their next opportunity. And so the way I liken it, it's I have an investor who has invested in a new personals web. It's the fastest growing personals website on the web right now, and it's called Zoosk. And I said, so what's, why did, you know, Match.com was created when I was starting out on the internet, you know, eHarmony wanted to have a better matching because, you know, you're going to get married, so the match has got to be awesome. I mean, it's going to be great. And he said, no, this is, Zoosk was built on Facebook platform. And, you know, it's not, you know, you don't go to Zoosk to get married, you just go there to, you know, to date, you know, to date people and kind of meet a lot of different people, right? Well, as I said, I was there in the beginning of Career Builder. Hot Jobs was bought by Monster, met the Monster board in October 94. That was like taking newspaper classifieds and moving them online, and you do research and you put your resume in there and hope to find a great job. And now, as you know, I think your employees could be two-timing you now because the explosion of things like Mechanical Turk. One of my product managers at hotjobs.com is the founder of a company called GigWalk. And what GigWalk does is that you can go to it right now, use your iPhone, and you'll see a lot of little gigs that you can accept. And it's usually around using your iPhone to take pictures of things, like Starbucks may hire it, so that you can go into the local Starbucks here and take a picture of what the score is looking like so that Starbucks can understand if, in fact, the display is correct. Or they want a picture of the billboard on the billboards along this freeway, or... And people are making extra money. You know, my assistant did it when he came to ask me to join his advisory board. My assistant then signed up for GigWalk. She does it frequently. And a lot of mothers go on Mechanical Turk and do extra work, make extra money. So what should a company do? So first, this is kind of a radical thing. If you're in the recruiting industry, you know this. Historically, recruiting... Unless you were an executive recruiter, recruiting was advertising a job, bringing in all the applications, and having a process of sifting the applications down to a limited number of people who are then worth interviewing for the job. And executive recruiting was about building this huge database of names because you never know if they'd be open to a new job or not, and staying in close contact with them. You know, Dan, how are you doing at Java? You still like it there? Would you possibly be interested in something else, right? Well, now because the competition for entry-level engineers, you know, manager-level people is so fierce that you've got to recruit like an executive recruiter at scale. So companies now are starting to create databases of prospects who've never even contacted them. How are they doing that? Well, they're using tools like JobVite, but they're going into LinkedIn. They're Googling like crazy, software engineer, Palo Alto, right? They're going on Facebook and making as many connections as they can. Companies are creating Facebook fan pages, and then when anyone says, I like it, they got that person's profile and they got that person's network of profiles, and they're building a database of prospects. They're building, as I argue, their own black book, but it's not a static database. It's constantly updated. So they're adding names to their database, and then it's tracking these individuals as they tweet, as they blog, and then they're running campaigns against that database. Hey, we're going to be at South by Southwest in Austin. We're going to have this party. You're invited. Or you can win a chance for an iPad or something like that to keep close and to keep the... It's just like people in marketing do. For marketers, this is normal. Right, you know, build a database of prospects, start marketing to them. But for recruiting, it's very different. But they're now starting to do it. Second thing is, you got to let everyone in the marketplace know that you're open to inquiries from them. Right, and involve as many people in getting the word out as possible. You know, if you're dating, you say, "Hey, look, I'm in the market." Not me. I'm still married to the woman I dated in high school. Twitter is a customer of ours at JobVite, and this is their VP of Human Resources, and she said that, you know, some of their best recruiters are their employees. So this is data from JobVite's platform. Pretty much any company you've read about going public, other than Facebook, is a customer of JobVite. All the companies have gone public in the internet industry, they all use JobVite for their recruiting. So we really have great data on what kinds of people are being hired, what kinds of jobs are open, how long does it take to fill them, how much does it cost to fill them. So we have this thing called the JobVite Index that we occasionally publish. Here's data right from that. So all the applications on JobVite, these are the sources. The number one source is, you know, Career Builder and Monster, my old industry. 42% of all applicants come from a job advertisement. 32% come from the company's own career site, which, by the way, is dramatically higher than it is in typical. That's because I think companies like Zynga and Zappos and Twitter, a lot of people want to work there, so they go to their career sites. And you can see it's kind of smattered. 6.9% are employee referrals. Now, JobVite enables any employee to share a job through Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter easily with a matching algorithm. So one of our value propositions to companies is trying to get them to do more employee referral hiring. If you look at the hires by source type, the majority, 40%, are coming from employee referrals. Right? The average American company generates 25% of their referrals of their hires through employee referrals. So there's something about this interconnected, networked community in the technology industry that is more attuned to this kind of hiring and ways for finding a job, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. So if you look at then the apply to hire conversion, where the most of the hires come from on a per application basis, employee referrals are dramatically higher, and sadly, my job board industry does a horrible job. Essentially, they send recruiters tons of unqualified applicants. Question? One of the other category would be, one in the other category would be a recruiter, in-house recruiter. Another would be The big one is, just escaped my mind for a second. Recruiter, job fairs, a non-employee referral. And the database. So a growing percentage of their database of prospects. Excuse me? Why is their effectiveness going down over time? Oh, yeah, yeah. For example, Google, the moment someone applies for a job at Google, they built their own software internally to manage this process, and it immediately sends out emails to certain areas inside Google saying, do you know this person? So the reason is that the filter that people most act quickly on is some sort of recommendation or some sort of thumbs up, thumbs down. And it's a whole lot easier for someone right now to say, you know what, I may know that person. Let me see for a second. You know, oh, I know someone who knows them. Here. And so that's why that's happening. And I was in a meeting yesterday with a very large company, extremely large company in Dallas. And he said that over the last 10 years, recruiters' behavior has changed. They've become more rote. He called them lazy. And he was a recruiter. And that they've forgotten how to do the job of actually helping a prospect see what it would be like to work at the company, because they've gotten used to just searching in Career Builder and searching in Hot Jobs and being lazy and just sending them off. And the complaint I got yesterday was that I have three different recruiters, and three different recruiters are sending me the same name. Yeah. Well, the thesis of the founders of JobVite was that software could put the power of recruiting into the hands of the hiring manager more and more. And we're seeing a lot of work, obviously, being pushed down via... I mean, we fill out forms online that we never would have filled out in the past, right? So it's not surprising that hiring managers now can go on LinkedIn, go search their own network. They can start pinging people. So you are seeing a lot of that. If you are recruiting in the high-tech world especially, social networks are a great place to find them. My daughter's a senior in college. She has interned at three different companies. She has a profile on LinkedIn and obviously she's been on Facebook since she was a freshman in high school. Her current internship's not on her LinkedIn profile because she's not on it all the time, whereas in Facebook she's on it. You know, I'm sure the little vibration on the phone while I've been giving this talk was her communicating something to me via Facebook. But her most current job is on her Facebook profile. And so they're continually engaged with it. If you compare the socioeconomic status, or the stats, if you will, of heavy users of social networks versus the rest of the population, they trend younger, wealthier, and better educated. They also update their profile more frequently. Heavy users of social networks versus light users. Maybe you can also argue extroverts versus introverts. They're more likely to get a job referral, and they're more likely to make more connections on social networks. Second thing that companies need to do is to take college recruiting more seriously and get people younger. I was blown away when I saw this on Kleiner Perkins' website. They're publishing their Kleiner Perkins Engineering Fellows. These are not graduates. These are undergraduates who've yet to graduate who are on Kleiner Perkins' website. And so they're starting to develop, and they know that you know, maybe one of these people may work at one of their companies, but they also know that these five people are socially connected to a ton of other very bright people on engineering and non-engineering, and that developing this kind of relationship is a way for them to build scale across the social graph. Nothing. So you should, if you're a recruiter. The other thing companies need to do is to be a better partner with their employees, you know, be less abusive, and to recognize that you'll eventually grow apart and just admit it. So I argue that recruiting is now going to become one of the most important, ongoing, never not done functions in a company. You will never stop doing it. So two more examples and I'm done here. This is a company, an online company that's in the online brokerage business. Their CEO started a 1 hour a week every Wednesday seminar to teach employees how to start their own company. And he was saying, look, I recognize that this is what they want to do, and I figure, you know, some may appreciate it and decide they don't want to start their own company and will stay, and some will leave. But then I'll have alumni that will appreciate what we've done for them. Zappos, which is also a JobVite customer, I don't know if you heard about this, but they have a 6-week training. Culture is incredibly important to the CEO of Zappos. And so much so, their hiring process is the most sophisticated I've seen. And if you're interested in it, I can tell you more about it. But one thing they started a year ago, which was pretty amazing, was at any time during the first 6 weeks, if anyone who's been offered a job at Zappos decides they don't want the job at Zappos, they'll pay you a bonus between $2,000 and $3,000. And it was his way of saying, look, you make mistakes. You made a mistake, maybe we made a mistake, you're not going to be happy. Don't stick here because you need the money. I'll give you a little bit of extra money so that you feel comfortable going to look and find another job. So that's my take on why I think the world's changing, and I think we'll continue to change and continue to accelerate. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to take them. Yeah. Well, it depends on the job. I mean, it really depends on the profession, the job. There are certain professions that just literally require the literal education, and you just have to have it in order to do it. Like, I was with a company yesterday in the roofing industry. They're the largest manufacturer of roofing material, and they have a research lab, and they need PhDs who can do research on new roofing materials, and there's a particular skill they got to have, and if they don't have it, they'll look for a year to a year and a half to find the right person. Yeah, absolutely, and less so in other fields, for sure. No. I didn't mean to imply that. I just think that I think you'll have to have retention strategies to maybe even maintain the churn rate. And you might see their churn rate go up anyway. If you don't do anything for retention, that's what I mean by be a better partner. It's a clever way of saying have some retention plans. I actually think that is critical and important. But at the end of the day, your company jobs are going to transform themselves in a way that you're not going to necessarily need all of them the way you need them today. And their career is going to need to evolve in such a way that they don't need you. In other words, I think it's almost going to be part of the natural evolution for people to move. And that, I know, when I first started interviewing people, there was this kind of assumption on your resume that if you had worked in a place less than 6-5 years, a little bit of, I wonder why, you know? Now, I'm convinced that anybody who's doing recruiting, if you've been somewhere for more than 3 to 4 years, it's, what have you been doing, right? And that's a big flip in a matter of 15 years. And I think the assumption is that if you've been there for more than 4 years and haven't changed jobs, you're not the kind of person who's going to deal with our dynamic environment where the jobs are changing because there's new roles to play. Search engine optimization didn't exist. Well, guess what? Now there's going to be social network optimization. And that title's probably out there. And no one knows how to do it. Oh, huge. Our culture, and I didn't talk about that because there's too much, but we are a consumer brand culture. You can see it here at South by Southwest. People who work at companies that, you heard me in my presentation, Zappos is a customer of Jobvite, right? You know, I'm not putting up the roofing guy up there. Our culture is about brands. And so young people especially gravitate towards brands. And so you really want to have a brand that means something, that someone can attach themselves to and believe in and feel like it's a good thing to be a part of. In the back? No? Yeah?
Yeah, I had a question. When you had mentioned that company that was actually explaining to their new employees, hey, here's how you can go and start your own business. I heard Google was also doing the same thing. There becomes a conflict of interest there. This I don't understand in the corporate world, and that's what I hope maybe you explain to me. Once I start teaching you how to start your own company, part of your day, which is instead of supposed to be doing your daily tasks, is now thinking about how to do your own thing.
Yeah, and I think...
And now you end up... How much of his day is being spent doing his job? You know,
yeah. That's the problem. I think the way they think about it is that there's a beginning, middle, and an end to any employee tenure at Google, and that they want to maximize the value they get out of that employee during that period of time, but they recognize they can't control, especially after 4 years of vesting in Google stock, they can't control the people. They can have retention programs, and I think their belief is that if someone, a young engineer who's really good, and it's highly competitive to get them, wants to think that one day they want to run their own company, if they think by going to Google that they're going to come out of it way more capable of doing it than they would if they didn't go to Google, then they'll attract more of those engineers. So then as they leave, they got a whole new supply coming in. So that the old way of recruiting was almost, I got to recruit someone and hope that they stay for a very long time. The new way of recruiting is, you know what? It's a flow, and I just got to manage a flow in and out of the company and recognize that that's the case. It's just like sales. If you don't have enough prospects at the top of the funnel, you ain't going to hit your numbers come the close of May. And I think Google seems it that way. I know I'm going to lose some. If you're a great sales executive, you know you're going to have closed lost opportunities as well as sales. If you sit there and fret that every single lead didn't turn into a sale, you're going to forget what you need to be doing at the top of the funnel, which is getting more prospects.
So I have sales. I monitor their work. How I monitor their work season, the number of calls.
Yes.
I count the number of calls.
Yes.
If they made 40 calls in a day, people, if they made 10, my question is, what were they doing?
Right.
They weren't doing work.
Right.
So what I'm saying here, I understand from the engineer level, but in other words, if the guy's making 10 calls a day and he does this for a month, guess what? I ain't paying him anymore.
Well.
So what they're saying there is, and I'm not trying to argue, I'm just trying to understand.
No.
Now Google's saying, hey, look, you're going to work for us.
Well, remember, Google's the company. Well, Google's the company that said Fridays you can keep for your own, right? So they already have a culture that says a portion of the day you need to be working on something on your own. And so that their culture is already kind of comfortable with that notion. So I'm sure inside Google it's, if you're going to want to learn how to be an entrepreneur, work on that on Fridays. So they've already made the calculation that they're okay with that. Now, and the only other thing I want to say about that is if they thought that that was going to change their culture so that it would go to lowest common denominator and they'd see productivity going down, I'm sure they would pull that back.
Then within that, again, from the work experience that I grew up with,
mm-hmm.
any idea you come up with, in our walls, we have
Yeah.
If you're working on a deal, so is right. that still, even though they have that fraud?
Oh, that's what you mean by conflict of interest. I get it.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I'm not a patent expert, and I think you raise a really interesting point. What I'm observing when I go to visit a company in the energy industry or in the roofing industry or in the insurance industry is a perception today that I didn't see 15, 20 years ago, that it is an incredibly competitive environment and that the only way their company is going to survive is to begin to at least partially, if not completely, reinvent itself. And so what they're looking for more today than they did in the past are people who've worked somewhere else, who have a different point of view that could help them with that transformation. And they're less interested in hiring the people who've done the same thing that everyone else in their company have done. I see that pattern across the board. And so that therefore, I think the rate of change is easy for people in the technology industry to think that, you know, we're different. I actually don't. I think it just happens faster here, but technology is changing virtually every industry now. Yeah?
Do you encourage people you're looking at to leave the job they're in? I mean, do you say you shouldn't be there for a
week? Yeah. Yeah. I say that my advice when people ask me is to really, have you ever sat down and mapped out what your career goals are over the next 10 years? And, you know, the answer 99 times is no. And not that you should follow it, but just think in that kind of way. Someone said to me a long time ago, you should always think that the job you're about to take leads to the job, what job you'll take after that. And my daughter's generation, when I talked to them, I just wrote this little blog post, innocently, just wrote this blog post about kids in your 20s, chill out, don't be so stressed out, because the economy was really bad 2 years ago, and they were panicking, like, I can't take a job that pays that little, and I wrote a blog post that says, take any job, just get started, you're going to change jobs 3 or 4 times in your 20s, relax, don't worry about it. It was that kind of tone. It got published like in the front page of all these different college newspapers. It like really resonated with them. And so my advice to them is just get started and get working, because they intuitively know that they have to learn how to build their career. We're going to have to recruit nonstop. They're going to have to search nonstop, because the dynamics of the economy are too fast. I don't know how much more time we got. Oh, yeah, we got.
So I work for the
Uh-huh. Little less dynamic.
Yeah, very less dynamic. And I'm actually trying to hire someone right now. I'm in the team.
Yep.
How do you see, I mean, are you familiar with the hiring process?
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, the government's very slow to get, you know, I tried many years ago to have Hot Jobs be the job board for the government. Monster actually got that contract. I think that some well-intentioned people want to adopt best practices in industry. And you know, it's interesting, we just did a deal, JobVite, with the federal government on enabling veterans who are coming back to apply for a job not with their resume or their LinkedIn profile, which we do, but with this veterans profile that they all have. So we changed our technology and let them do that. That was pretty forward thinking, and an initiative. They call it the Blue Button Initiative. So I would imagine there are very smart people in the government who wishes they could move faster. They compete in the labor market with private companies, so they have no choice but but to compete on salary, to compete on career opportunities. Now, one thing for risk-averse people, maybe they're attracted more to government roles and they can, I don't want to manage my career as much, but then, you know, there's probably less pay, and so it's a trade-off. But yes, government will always kind of follow where industry's going. Yes? Correct, right. Yeah, I mean, my daughter's best friend and roommate's has accepted a job with the FBI. She's thrilled. So, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time, and it was